think because they don't understand that you can't have belief without unbelief. Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. It goes hand in hand. It makes a belief stronger, actually, to have confronted those moments of doubt and to say, I believe. That's what I have worked with students. You know, they tend to enter as freshmen, seeing the world in black and white. And what my job as a writing professor was, is to teach them to learn to live in the gray and to celebrate it, and to not be afraid of it.
Jill Pelaez Bumgartner is Professor Emerita and former Dean of Humanities and Theological Studies at Wheaton College. The author of several collections of poetry as well as scholarly books on such writers as Flannery O'Connor, she currently serves as a poetry editor at the Christian Century. We talked today about a beautiful volume of poems she recently edited titled Taking Root in the Heart, a collection of 34 poets from the Christian Century. I'm Matthew Wickman of BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute. Jill Pelaez Bumgartner, it is a delight to see you. Thank you for coming on and talking with me today.
Well, it's wonderful to be invited to do this. Thank you for having me.
So we're talking today about the book you recently edited, titled Taking Root in the Heart, a collection of 34 poets from the Christian Century. We might be talking about many of the facets of your career, right? Your own published poetry, your time as professor of English at Valparaiso, then at Wheaton College, and also your perspective onto higher education as Dean of Humanities and Theological Studies, also at Wheaton. Given the diversity of your career and these multiple lines of prospective inquiry, right? Poet, scholar, teacher, administrator, I'll ask you a simple question actually here at the outset. How did you get involved as poetry editor for the Christian Century, a job you've held since 1996?
Well, it actually goes back beyond the 90s, back into the 80s, the 70s, really. I was teaching at Valparaiso University as an instructor. It was before I went back for my doctorate. I was asked to look at some of the poetry that had been piling up on the desk of Ken Corby, who was editor of the Crescent, and to tell him what should be done with it. And so that was my first plunge into this world of poetry editing. I did that for 15 years at Valpo. After I left Valpo and went to graduate school and then went to Wheaton, I was still poetry editor of the Crescent. Then the editor of the Crescent at that time, Jim Nectarline, was invited by Richard John Newhouse to become managing editor of this new publication at the time in New York called First Things. And Nectarline asked me if I would take on the poetry editing, and I said I'd be delighted to. That lasted 3 years. I love Richard John Newhouse for many reasons, but I think, you know, we had a parting of the ways over my taste in poetry, which was quite different from his. And so it was about that time that my good friend David Heim, who was senior editor at the Christian Century, became good friends. He and his wife became our good friends. And one day I was talking to him about the quality of the poetry that I was finding in the Christian Century, which I didn't think was very good. In fact, one of the editors said to me that when they had white space and they didn't have a poem to fill it, they'd just make something up and put it in there as a poem. So anyway, I said to David Heim, you know what, you really need me as poetry editor. If not me, someone, you need a poetry editor. And so, lo and behold, that happened. And so that was my entree into Christian Century poetry editing. 1996.
Wow, okay. I mean, the book is full of these beautiful poems. So clearly you've done some excellent, excellent work there. And there are these days clearly very good poems published in the Christian Century. I've got to ask you quickly, before I ask you more questions on this, I'm curious, you're also a poet. Is the skill and the inspiration and kind of the eye for writing poetry similar, in your view, to the same talents or skills or sensibilities that go into the editing of poetry, or do they come from very different sides of your brain?
And that's a good question, because they're linked in my mind. But that's because that's the way I've kind of lived my life. I didn't really become serious about my own poetry until I began to edit poetry. And by editing poetry, I don't mean I sit there with a red pen and change poems. I mean select poetry. And when I find a poem which is almost there but not quite, communicate with the author about what I think could happen in a particular line, and then that author does the revision. I've learned so much from the poems that I have read through my career as an English professor, but also through my career as a poetry editor. And that really drives my own work.
That makes sense. Yeah, I know one of the things that often scholars talk about, or creative writers, is the first step to writing well is to read a lot and read well. And clearly you have to do that as poetry editor. I've got to ask you, so you've been editing the poems there at Christian Century since 1996, which is the year I got married, so I know exactly how long that is.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, are there any potential changes in poetry that you've seen in the journal that reflect broader changes in American poetry, or do you think there's something distinctive about Christian poetry, something intrinsic there to shifts in voice or form or style? In other words, do these things map on each other, you know, sort of broad poetry and like American poetry and religious poetry, or are they different lines really of poetic production?
Well, I have seen changes, of course, in the poetry world outside of the world of poetry written by Christians. And I've seen the way that influences poetry written by Christians. Poetry written by Christians isn't always Christian poetry.
Right.
Although I have objected in my own work and then been proven wrong, saying that, you know, a particular poem doesn't necessarily reveal my Christian identity. And then it's been pointed out to me that, yes, here you reveal it, here you reveal it, here you reveal it. And I had not intended to. So the identity is there. I think Flannery O'Connor said something about the identity of the Christian writer. You know, it's not something spread over the top of a piece of literature. It's in the depths of the literature. What has happened, I think, in recent years in the world of poetry is narcissism has taken hold. It's not necessarily the case that poets are wanting to communicate with readers. And I think what has happened here has been twofold. One is the influence of performance poetry, which is can be wonderful. I enjoy it, but it doesn't lead to good poetry written on the page. And it's a challenge to put it into print. So I see that in the submissions I get, I see that kind of influence. I don't accept those poems. An example from Poetry Magazine from a few years ago was a performance poet. They were trying to represent her work on the page, and it came out as just scribbles, several pages of scribbles. So no, you know, that's not the kind of change that I can go along with, and that's not the kind of change we publish. As far as what makes the Christian poet unique, I think, is that poet is trying to connect with something larger than the self, away from narcissism. It's got to communicate, and it's got to connect with something larger than the selves.
Okay. You write something to that effect in your introduction, and I'll ask you a couple questions about the introduction here in a moment, but I'll just quote you here. You ask the question, what do I look for in the poems I choose for publication? And you respond, I'm interested in poems which defy the narcissistic tendencies of so much contemporary poetry. I don't seek a particular orthodoxy, but I do want the poems to connect with something larger than the self. I search for poetry that attempts to revitalize language, especially theological language. Look for poems that attempt to upset the usual modes of expression and offer up new angles of vision, especially in regard to biblical stories. For most of our poems, and not all by any means, Jesus is the Word made flesh, and the Incarnation is the paradigm of as poets attempt to enflesh the abstract. So I seek poems that make the Spirit tangible and put into words the unsayable. I really love that last bit there. In that, I mean, the whole thing here is a good justification of what you're looking for in poetry. But I love that bit about making Spirit tangible and putting into words unsayable. It kind of suggests that poetry does what might seem illogical or impossible, reversing in some ways the mystical tendency toward apophasis or the insistence that we can never speak fully about God. You're saying, true, but you want poems to do that anyway, actually to make the Spirit tangible anyway. I find that provocative.
Yeah, you know, I recently wrote a poem myself about where one finds reality. And I decided in this poem, it's kind of a radical statement for me, that it doesn't necessarily exist in the priest's pronouncements, in the world of art that tries to represent biblical truth. The closest I can come to it is in music, and particularly in Bach. Mm. and that's where it is. It lies elsewhere. It lies elsewhere is what I end up saying. Yeah.
That's a provocative phrase, it lies elsewhere. Let me ask you about poems in venues that are religious, you know, sort of publications. So introduction to the volume, again, you remarked that so many Christian publications include poetry right in their pages. You mention, obviously, the Christian Century. There is the Anglican Review, Crescent, First Things, Spiritus, Image, Presence, Wendover. We could add more, like journals like Christianity and Literature, or the journal of which I serve as editor, Literature and Belief. And the list could go on. That's not an exhaustive list by any means. Why do all these venues include poetry? Or to put the question maybe a little bit differently, what does poetry bring to these venues?
You know, I also say in my introduction, I quote William Carlos Williams, who said that it is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. And what is found there are the big questions. The big questions, not necessarily presented as big questions, sometimes found in the micro realities of our world. In this world of horror, there is that one, that photograph I've seen recently of a little bee asleep in a flower. Now that could lead to a very sentimental and awful poem, but that image sticks with me. A little bee, you know, asleep in a flower, and that brings up a lot of big questions. It also brings up questions that don't have answers that we really can plug into. Questions about suffering. Questions about theodicy. So that's what I think we are looking for. If not answers, at least pictures that we can connect to, that connect us then with this larger force in the universe.
Okay, that's really beautiful. I'm going to quote you again in the introduction on that kind of subject that I find really profound in what you say. You write, the poetry brings into focus suffering or beauty or fear or God's compelling presence or absence, as the case may be. Poetry is a kind of real presence, spirit and word and concrete images, a means of charity, clemency, and mercy, even in the midst of anger and frustration and disillusion. And as you point out, just in this conversation we're having right here, you know, you can find those things, really profound things, large things in small circumstances that be in the flowers, so illustrative, right? Or the small things in one's life, a passing thought, a reflection, a brief conversation with somebody, not about the big things, but about where you perceive something in that person. Poetry seems to me really kind of touches it. It lights in on those moments and says, pay attention right here. Something more significant is happening than would meet the kind of the eye at first glance.
Exactly, exactly. Pay attention. Yes, that's exactly right.
You know, I'd love to give listeners a feel for the kinds of poems that appear in the collection. And so I'm wondering if we could maybe each of us choose a couple of poems which were drawn in the volume. I know you're drawn to all of them because you included them. And I love more than we can get to here. But maybe we each chose a couple and maybe read the poems and then discuss them for a couple of minutes. Does that sound okay with you?
That would be great.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. I'm going to go first by reading a poem by Anya Silver. Called After the Biopsy. Anya died at the age of 49, just a handful of years ago. She had had metastatic breast cancer for 14 years. She was an extraordinary poet.
I love her poetry.
Oh, it's amazing. But anyway, this particular book, this particular poem has an epigraph by Simone Weil. And the epigraph is this: each time that we have some pain to go through, we can say to ourselves quite truly that it is the universe, the order and beauty of the world, and the obedience of creation to God that are entering our body. After that, how can we fail to bless this tenderest gratitude, the love that sends us this gift? Hmm. And this is the poem. The pathology report an icon. The tissue staining the slide, God's kaleidoscope. And those cells obeying their DNA, cosmic dust as they whirl and split. Why not praise cancer, relentless, blind, that seeks and finds the lymph and blood? Because I am unthankful, rude. Because if I linger over this gift, I will change. I will vanish from the earth. In Russia, an icon of Mary has wept for 20 years. Mary, do you see my nuclei mutating like words in whisper down the lane? This same God took your son away. Help me disobey.
Wow.
Yeah. The complete irony and turning it all upside down. She does that so well.
She does. I love the way in several volumes she does that, and especially about matters of illness. I mean, she really kind of fashioned that into a really, really sharp instrument to get into some really poignant issues of belief and relationship and across her poetry. Here, this is great. Why not praise cancer, relentless blind that seeks and finds the lymph and blood? I mean, it's, you know... in its own way, cancer, you know, when seen across God's kaleidoscope, the tissue staining the slide, it can look beautiful from an extreme distance, but boy, not from up close. And that again, that sense of poignancy and those two things existing side by side, I think are brought so powerfully and painfully to bear in this poem.
Yes, it's beauty and suffering at the same time. And what's the answer? This same God took your son away, as she says to Mary, help me disobey.
There's something Edenic about that, disobeying in order to acquire more life, right?
Yes, exactly. Oh, that's good. I like that.
Here's one I'd turn our attention to. It's on page 51. This is by Charles Hughes. It's called New Year's Geese. I'll read this here. Again, another beautiful poem. El Nino winter, January. Geese fly high above this still suburban street, so high I hear their cries, then have to strain to see them. Not a V, dark flecks of ink bunched on a gray construction paper sky. They're indistinct, seemingly in distress, moving as bubbles move in boiling water, and getting nowhere. Honking wildly, they appear to have encountered unawares some mortal and invisible enemy. I can't help but admire their stamina. Minutes go by. The geese keep grappling with whatever chaos holds them in its grip. I'm thinking, who does better most days? When suddenly silence falls. For no clear reason, the non-stop caterwauling stops. 1 second, and two, and three, eternity, but brief. A single voice takes up its chant-like call. Others call back, and back and forth the geese soon antiphon themselves into formation, a fresh, clean V in which they vanish. Me? There can be mercy deep in memory, I found, unseen, piercing as parting sound. You know, I love this poem. Many things, there's an elegance to it. The internal rhyme in the last line, I found unseen, piercing as parting sound, kind of bringing through that kind of accent of the rhyme, a real focus onto that last poignant bit in the poem. But something that strikes me at the poem is the elegant way it takes a common trope of religious poetry, you know, kind of poet gazing on nature as a gateway to the divine. You think about like The Windhover by Gerard Manley Hopkins, for example, gazing at a kestrel and suddenly seeing through that some kind of epiphany about the nature of God. But in this poem, instead of a straightforward religious vision, the poet instead gives expression to a subtler feature of spiritual life, these kinds of recessions in memory, or these folds in everyday experience, you know, where you experience something sacred, that to name it just that would be too blunt, right? There's something subtler about the articulation that captures the subtle nature of these really beautiful sacred experiences. I love that about this poem.
You use the word elegant. I find that in all of Chuck Hughes's poems. And I know him. He works. He does not write fast. He works and works and works on a poem. And it shows here. Every single word is exactly right.
Yes, it is. It is. It's a beautiful, beautiful poem. I hope readers could pick that up in the way I read it, to see it and to read it as you see it. I think it's even richer.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to read one on page 108. It's Suffer the Little Children. Actually, he wrote this poem in response to a poem I wrote about Jesus inviting the little children to him. Hmm. And this was Rabbi Pupko's response. To the ghettos, Warsaw, Vilna, Lodz, Lublin. Then little children were brought to Jesus, Sarah, Rebecca, Leah, Rachel, for him to place his hands on them and pray for them. Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Yosef. But the disciples rebuked those who brought them. Miriam, Yoshevet, Sephora, Elisheva. Jesus said, let the little Baraks, Gideons, Shemshons, Shmuels, children come to me, Issachars, Zebulons, Gads, Ashers, and do not hinder them, Tirzas, Batshevas, Annas, Peninas, for the kingdom of heaven, Auschwitz, Treblinka, Madianek, Sobibor, belongs to such as these. Shlomos, Hezekiahs, Yeshayahus, Yirmiyahus. When he had placed his hands on them, Yentls, Soshas, Mendeleys, Sprintzas, he went on from there. Belzec, Chelno, Platzel, Buchenwald, and the little children came. Mm. Gives me chills. I've read that poem 100 times and it still gives me chills. And when I read my poem and then read his poem at poetry readings, which I do now, it's totally silent afterwards.
Yeah, I'll bet. One thing readers don't catch from hearing it only, the lines alternate, you know, every other line is in italics, and the italics, you know, comes from scriptural account, right, where children come to Jesus, and he says, you know, sort of, let the little children come to me, do not hinder them, etc. In between are these lines of these Jewish names.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very powerful effect, right? Very sobering.
Yes, and yet so simple in a way, you know? But the irony is so strong.
It is. It's a very powerful poem. And he's got a few in here where he kind of comments on the relationship between Judaism and Christianity in the long history of it. In ways that are, I mean, really striking and sobering. How did he begin writing for Christian Century?
Again, it was a interesting series of events. He became friends with David Heim, who was then editor. One of the things that Rabbi Pupko does is his job is to work on Christian Jewish relations.
Mm.
And so Christian Century had for many years been known for its, I think, anti-Semitic stance, so pro-Palestinian that it was anti-Semitic. And so he took it upon himself to get to know the Christian Century staff. And I got to know him through David Heim. As it turned out, he was leading a interfaith dialogue, which still is going on at Wheaton, between the Old Testament professors and rabbis from Chicago. And because I was dean of that division, not because I was any sort of biblical scholar, he invited me, and the president of Wheaton invited me to be a part of that conversation, which I still am. And then I found out he wrote poetry, but he hadn't published anything. And so I asked to see some of his poems, and one thing led to another. And pretty soon we worked on a book of his together, and he, you know, found a publisher, and he has a book out now.
I so. Love that. That's great. You know, Sophia, the podcast producer, and I have served together on BYU's University Council for Interfaith Engagement. And you are giving me, Jill, some awfully good ideas to take back to the person who runs that committee. I love that story about how you worked with him and how he's worked with others around Wheaton. It sounds like a very productive conversation to have.
Yeah, very.
Let me go over one more poem, if I may, myself here from this volume. Again, it's such a great volume. This is, I'm going to turn us to Bonnie Thurston's poem, Was Blind But Now I See, on page 151.
All right.
It's not a lengthy poem, but it's really, I think it's a profound poem. It too has an epigraph. This is from Oedipus Rex, book by Tiresias. You have your sight and yet you cannot see. Here's the poem. Driving into the city to teach in gray-green late summer, I see one flaming red maple and think of Oedipus standing dangerously above the hoi polloi. But it is Moses' tree, a call story on a highway hillside. I want to stop traffic, shout, take off your shoes, people, for the world is on fire with a beauty so fragile that, like the thread of ash after the stick of incense burns, one breath can topple it.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. It's a wonderful poem.
I love it. Two things about the poem struck me when I read it. First, that sense of beauty that goes unnoticed, unseen. It's a sense I think a lot of us encounter in beautiful things. I mean, whether we see a beautiful thing and we realize we miss a lot. If you see a thing you don't look at often and you think, wow, how beautiful, you realize you're not seeing so much because your head's other places. And so this poem describes the feeling we have of indignation, not only others, but also we ourselves are often blind to the beauty of the world, and especially perhaps the created world. The world is what the book of Genesis describes as good, right, as God's work of art. But second, I'm also struck by the beauty about being fragile, like the thread of ash after the stick of incense burns. You know, that kind of fragility speaks for me to a space in which spiritual perceptions so often occur, or perhaps to which these perceptions sensitize us, perceptions of such acuity and poignancy that are so subtle. It's like you have this sense of something where things are clear, and you wish you could sort of keep that moment, then it kind of disappears. But it's also a reminder, you know, of what it means to come into contact with spiritual things and sort of recognize them as such. The poem, so I guess it's the contrast between the poem's loud indignation on the one hand, but also its really delicate sensibilities that I find so striking.
And this is a perfect example of the one flaming red maple, the one thing that awakens this entire set of connections, and this particularly this connection with something much larger than the self. Now, let me tell you about Bonnie Thurston. She's published 39 books of theology.
Whoa.
She is a serious theologian, and she writes this poetry too. You don't often find that combination, but she is remarkable.
That's amazing. I did not know she was that prolific.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Well, I'm going to go look for more of what she has to write. I do know a couple of poets who've kind of done the theology and poetry kind of two-step, who are remarkably good at it, and others who don't do it as well, but they like doing it, right? Yeah. Let me ask you, clearly, okay, so you're a lover of poetry generally, and not just religious poetry, and I'm wondering then whether you perceive things that non-religious poets or poems do that you wish might be realized more fully in the work of religious poets, right? Are there places where you wish religious poems could go that they seem not to or don't go yet? Or do you believe that poetic possibility is just as open, if not more so, to religious poets as it is to non-religious poets?
Of course, I taught poetry writing to undergraduates for a number of years. And what I discovered among these primarily evangelical students was that they were very afraid to go into areas of doubt and unbelief. Now, I find the mature poet who is Christian is not afraid to do that. I think it sometimes surprises those people who are not religiously inclined to find that in the poetry, and they don't, and it puzzles them. I think because they don't understand that you can't have belief without unbelief. Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief.
Yes.
It goes hand in hand. It makes a belief stronger, actually, to have confronted those moments of doubt and to say, I believe, instead. So anyway, that's what I have worked with students. You know, they tend to enter as freshmen, at least during the years I was teaching, seeing the world in black and white. And what my job as a writing professor was, is to teach them to learn to live in the gray and to celebrate it and to not be afraid of it.
That is profound advice. I love it. That is so good. And those are hard lessons learned. Right, because especially people who come from religious backgrounds, you know, where you're trying to live in and prove yourself worthy, which means believing entirely and utterly, you know. And you got to figure. I like to think that the God must smile on such little children, but you know, there's a point at which you know you can no longer see in such childish ways if you really want to draw closer to God. It requires that you acquire some real depth of being. One more poem in here. Maybe you can comment. This is Tanya Runyon, who quoted this great sonnet for myself at 17. Okay, which sounds like this. She writes this: to the one I love who played violin and twirled your hair with gracious angst, you pried clean off your grip on sin to sing with far and wide and deep and lost. You didn't realize black and white would blind you, that Tchaikovsky's music pours from light despite vodka and trysts with men to bind him. You're either for or against the word of Christ, But didn't you know Jesus rolled into view every time you underlined sadnesses in books you couldn't explain? His words, so hidden and new, bloomed from the gray, the silt-specked muck. You drew your bow across a weary string. The notes were always right, but didn't ring.
Yes. I love that poem. It's so defines my exposure and my friendship with so many of the freshmen at Wheaton College over the years.
Yeah, it's a great, I love that poem too. And it speaks exactly to your point of what you try to teach and instill in these students who would be writers of poetry, who need to kind of reach deeply into themselves, into their own faith to find what's there and not there, and deal with both, right?
Yeah,
belief and unbelief,
absolutely,
both.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you one last question here. This is a great conversation, Chill. I could talk to you for a much longer time. I mentioned at the outset of our conversation today that you've had a successful and a diverse career, right? As a poet and a scholar and a teacher and administrator. Let me close with a question that draws upon your breadth of experience and perspective. So one hears and reads widely these days about crises in the humanities, right? Problems of enrollment and funding and of what is taught and how it's taught and by and for whom it's taught and so on and so on. Is there a facet of this crisis that applies in particular to religious institutions like Wheaton or like BYU where I work? How bullish, perhaps, or concerned are you about the state of the humanities in religious colleges and universities?
I am very concerned about the state of humanities in our culture, in the secular institutions. But what I'm finding is that the humanities are alive in religious institutions. They're thriving. They're driving the curriculum. It's fascinating to me. But of course, every small Christian college now has had its crisis, is in the middle of a crisis. And even at Wheaton, we've had to make some cutbacks, et cetera. But do you know the writing programs at Wheaton College is stronger than ever, and this is what I hear everywhere. I think something has happened in the high schools. But one thing that I think has really worked against us in the humanities has been, and this will sound very micro, I'm sure, the advanced placement exams. Where students, check off some of those first courses that they would have had in college in the humanities, which means they never get a chance to be exposed to those wonderful teachers, to be hooked forever by a history professor or an English professor or a philosophy professor. Instead, they check off and they go on and they do other things, and they succumb to the pressures of the culture. STEM is wonderful. I would never denigrate STEM, but we've got to add to it. We can offer so much more than that. Plus, what I discovered, no one had told me, even in those years when I was dean, I discovered when I spent a term as interim provost, I discovered how much money was spent in the sciences. Even to attract those professors, they need startup labs, they need startup costs. In the humanities, we're so cost effective.
Yeah.
All we need is a classroom and students and books and set us free. And I'm very hopeful, and I'm particularly happy to see Christian colleges, religious institutions pick this up and run with it.
That's great. We're recording this interview in the summer and to be released in the fall. And earlier today, I kid you not, I sent out a tweet actually about my experience teaching at BYU about how the crisis in the humanities isn't really a thing at religious universities. It's the same way, not the same way as it is a lot of other places and a lot of secular institutions. And I mentioned, I was at a wedding last weekend, and folks there got just a teach at BYU. What do you teach? I mentioned things I teach. One of the classes I teach is a class on literature and spiritual experience. I started getting question after question after question from people about, well, what are you reading? What does that mean? What are you doing? What comes out? And they were so interested and engaged. It wasn't because these are literature lovers per se. It's that what drew us together was the religious community, with literature as a way to reflect on the nature of how we understand the things that we hold in common, that level of faith, and it really was a unifier. And I find that happening all the time in conversations that I have with people about the work I do at BYU, even when they're not attracted or probably not attached to the university. So it's really important. And I do think also that I'm for that reason, I'm hopeful that there's a good future for the humanities at these institutions, and hopefully beyond these kinds of institutions, all institutions, yeah. But at the very least, certainly these.
I would like to mention one thing that I've been doing the past, actually since 1978, I started a religion and literature group at my church.
Mm.
We have been meeting since 1978.
Wow.
We are the mother of all book groups, but we don't call ourselves a book group. And so this year I just set up the schedule. We're reading Dante's Inferno, we're reading Crime and Punishment, we're reading Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, etc., James Baldwin. And this group grows, you know. Sometimes we dwindle. Some years we've dwindled down to 8 or 10. We're up to 20, 25 now. We meet in homes once a month. It's just been wonderful.
That's a great idea. This is such a delight to talk with you. It really is. And I gained so much from reading this beautiful book of yours, Taking Root in the Heart. And thank you for talking today, Jill, and for the great work that you've done for a long time in many domains, but especially for the great work you've done with this book.
Thank you so much, Matthew. This has been really a fun half hour with you, really.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.